Well, it's a problem for contemporary history in general if you're trying to catch history on the run in this way. The point of a retrospective after a year is that what happened in Egypt, Tunisia, Libya was very dramatic. Long-standing dictators that had been there for decades were removed by popular movements. And then the question comes, what next? And at the time, we had no real idea of what next. And, there were fairly serious people in Washington, D.C. who were claiming that al-Qaeda would take over these countries. And there were fears of renewed war and so forth. Well, what's happened in the past year is that Tunisia and Egypt have turned to parliamentary politics in a big way. And in Tunisia in particular, the transition seems to have gone relatively smoothly, the best you could hope for, I think. In general, it has been the case that Muslim religious parties have done well where there have been elections. And I think elections are scheduled in Libya this summer. If they're pulled off, it's certainly the case that the religious parties will do well there as well. And so the Arab Spring is turning into an Islamist wave, as many observers have put it. But it in my view, it is Muslim fundamentalist politics with a difference, which is that in the old days, it wasn't clear that those religious parties really had bought in to the Westminster system, to parliamentary politics. And this time, they're the ones who are handling it, and they seem really committed to it. And so people had always said, well, you know, it's like the Nazis, if there'll be one election one time, and then they'll just kind of prorogue parliament and take over. But there's no sign whatsoever in Tunisia or Egypt of them doing that. And in fact, where they have a possibility of coalitions, they're preferring to ally with relatively secular forces. And there's a continuing kind of struggle between the new parliamentary elected bodies and the holdovers of the old regimes, the military and secret police and so forth, where those haven't been abolished as in Egypt. So I think this evolution of the revolts, which were mainly led by young left-of-center people, into an opportunity in the parliamentary realm for the religious forces, which had been repressed in these countries, to start playing, I would argue, the kind of role that the Christian Democrats, say, play in Germany. Or you could make an analogy to the religious right in the United States as a caucus inside the Republican Party, which drew in evangelicals to national politics in a way that was not true in the 50s. And this is what's really happening now in the Arab world.
Much attention was paid to Arab Spring in a popular fashion in the United States and the West. And I think a danger is when you have a large amount of people paying attention to something or to a country that they haven't paid much attention to until an event. I guess what I'm asking is, we, as a population, we don't always seem very informed about Tunisia or about Syria or about Egypt until there is this historic. And is there a danger in making sort of knee-jerk conjectures about what might happen? That, you know, you saw social media light up that now Egypt is free or now al-Qaeda will come in. There isn't a very nuanced approach by many.
Well, that's true. I mean, I think it's and the social media aren't very nuanced about American politics either.
Well, that's, yeah.
Clearly, you know, the United States educational system tends not to teach much in the way of world history. There is a world history movement among high school teachers, which is vital and has been spreading. And I think it's all to the good. But we often get, you know, our state history three or four times in K through 12, and then we get our national history three or four times. And sometimes we get some Europe, but usually not, funnily enough, after about 1848. So most Americans don't know about the revolutions of 1848. A lot of sort of more cultured commentators were comparing the Arab Spring to the European revolutions of 1848. And I thought to myself, you know, who do they think they're talking to? Because it's not as if you can make a comparison to something that's unknown in the American public, at least. And so by the time you get to the global south and the Arab world and Southeast Asia and so forth, obviously general knowledge is low. But I think people get up to speed pretty quickly when there's something of interest to them. And I think there's a difference in this regard with regard to Egypt, because I think a lot of Americans know a lot about Egypt. A lot of Americans go there on tourism. They're more interested in ancient Egypt than they are in the contemporary, but you can't see mm-hmm. ancient Egypt unless you go through the contemporary one. And so what struck me was that actually the analysis of Egypt was relatively sophisticated. And I think it's interesting because a lot of the foreign policy issues the U.S. has faced in the greater Middle East have been in countries like Iraq or Afghanistan, where frankly, even among college professors, there wasn't much of a stock of knowledge about those countries because you couldn't go there and do field work and so forth. Egypt is a known quantity. So yes, for Americans, Tunisia is maybe a little bit of a stretch, but then it's something that's intimately known by the French-speaking world, and you could always piggyback on their knowledge. So I actually have found that the Arab Spring probably has been dealt with by our press and public in a somewhat more sophisticated way than some of the earlier conflicts. I mean, I think people in this country got Iraq and Afghanistan like completely wrong for the most part, even at a high level. I don't think that was necessarily true of the Arab Spring. And the expectation that, for instance, in Egypt, that the Muslim Brotherhood would do well in the parliamentary elections was widespread, and people understood mm-hmm. that's what's likely to happen. So there weren't huge surprises.
I mentioned that social media hasn't been that nuanced, but of course social media does makes things differently. I think of Homs in Syria. There's a chance that we know much more or have seen much more because of social media than we would have 5 or 10 years ago.
Oh, absolutely. Well, the internet is crucial to this kind of thing. And the videos that are coming out from Syria, which are heartbreaking, would have been impossible to produce and impossible to disseminate earlier. And you can see the difference. In 1982, the Syrian government conducted a massacre in the city of Hama, which we only know about from survivors' accounts. If they managed to survive and escape Syria, you could interview them and so forth. But there's no documentary or visual information about that massacre. And they brought in bulldozers and just like knocked over people's homes with people in them. But there was not the same kind of first-person experience of it through YouTube and so forth that we're seeing in Homs now. So that it makes a huge difference, I think, and the world is changing in this regard, that what used to be hidden and distant is now close and visible.
There's no way to really answer this, but it makes a difference in what we know. Do you think it can make a difference in what happens, say, in Syria?
Well, I think that it puts pressure on international actors to try to do something. The Syrian revolt in particular is extremely inconvenient for the world community because a lot of people in the international community are very afraid of what would come after the fall of the Ba'ath Party in Syria. And there is a very lively Salafi or sort of hard right Muslim fundamentalist movement there. You know, the Muslim fundamentalists in Syria smuggled weapons over to the Muslim fundamentalists in Iraq with which to fight the American troops and to fight the Shiite government that the Americans installed in Baghdad. Now it seems clear that the Iraqis are buying up those weapons and smuggling them back into Syria. Well, this is all very concerning, and it's, I think, largely seen as a threat to order. So I think what everybody would like is if President Bashar al-Assad would step down and the Syrian elite would open to free and fair parliamentary elections, as happened in Tunisia, and that would kind of solve the problem and maybe forestall a more radical solution. And you could have a revolution in Syria ultimately of very angry people storming the presidential palace and dragging the president's body through the street, and then who knows who comes up mm-hmm. on top in such a situation. So I think the knowledge we have of what's going on in places like Homs, which is coming out through social media, puts pressure on the international community not to let it slide, that something should be done. But, of course, Syria is a hard nut to crack because the Russians and the Chinese have been blocking any outside intervention in Syria. And they're afraid of a repeat of the Libya scenario. They don't want NATO going in and changing the government and mm-hmm. shaping a new one because they have interests in Syria. So unlike Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya, all of which resulted in the overthrow of the dictator in a relatively short period of time, the Syrian struggle has been going on now for a year. And what's remarkable to me is that the opposition seems to go from strength to strength and hasn't petered out. But it hasn't had any particular successes either. Mm-hmm. Usually in these movements, either you succeed fairly quickly or, as in Iran in 2009, it kind of goes away. And so it makes me think that whatever's going on in Syria has legs. It's not going to subside soon. And it makes you think that this government would have trouble surviving over the medium term. But we could still be talking about this next year this time.